This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Shivotim hayu asukim b'mechiroso shel Yosef. The tribes, the brothers of Yosef, the sons of Yaakov, were all heavily preoccupied with the issue of the sale of Yosef. The Yosef, what about Yosef? What was he doing at that time? He was in sackcloth and fasting. He was in a state of mourning and terrible aggravation and despair. Reuven, what was Reuven doing at that time? Reuven, you remember, came back to the pit. He had suggested that Yosef not be killed, but rather be thrown into the pit. And his idea was to come back later on and save Yosef. He comes back to the pit and he looks there, and Yosef not to be found. So Reuven is in a terrible state. He's distraught and he's in his sackcloth. But Yaakov, what was Yaakov? What was the father doing at that time? So he was distraught and sitting in sackcloth and fasting. Yehuda? And what about Yehuda? He was busy getting married. So each person doing his own thing. He was looking for a wife. His wife had died. Even before his wife had died, his first marriage was at that time. Ba'kodesh Baruch Hu, what was God busy doing? Everybody's so preoccupied, each one doing their own thing. What was God busy doing? Ba'kodesh Baruch Hu, ayo isek, boire oiroi shel melech ha-Mashiach. He was busy creating the beginnings of the Mashiach. Interestingly, there are two aspects to Mashiach. There's the Mashiach that will come from the house of Yosef, and there's the Mashiach that will come from the house of Yehuda, and both of them were beginning to be formulated at this particular point. The Melech HaMashiach that the Medrash is talking about is the descendant of Yehuda, and that's why, stuck right in the middle of this, we're told the story of Yehuda. Very strange story. Just after Yosef's been sold to the Ishmaelim, we're told that Yehuda leaves his brothers and sets up business on his own. And according to some, he was actually removed by his brothers after this whole business. He gets married, he has two children, he gets three children. He marries his first one off to Tamar, who's the daughter of Malki Tzedek, from a very important family, from the house of Shem. The first son dies, and he marries her to the second son. Things don't go well at all, and the second son doesn't behave himself, and he dies. And Yehuda then tells her to wait for the third son until he's older, and he'll marry her to the third son. Although, according to some, he had no intention of doing that. According to Rashi, lo yo bedatu lahasiya lo, Rashi says. He never intended to marry her off to the third son. She realizes that. She knows for certain that she is meant to marry this family, and she's meant to have children from this family, and that from this union Mashiach will come. She knows that with Nebuah. She knows prophetically that Mashiach will come out as a result of a union between herself and the family of Yehuda. There are only three sons. The first two have died, and there's one left, and she knows that Yehuda has no intention of marrying her to the third son. So there's only one thing left for her, and that's to marry Yehuda. Yehuda has lost his wife, and the only thing left for her is to marry Yehuda, which in those days was permitted. Not only permitted, but was part of the mitzvah of Yibum. So she then goes, and when she understands that he's going to be in a good mood, business has gone well, and he's going to celebrate, she plants herself at the crossroads, dresses up like a prostitute. Yehuda walks past, and amazingly, Yehuda, the great Yehuda, falls for her, has relations with her, and then can't find her again. She disappears out of his life, even though he owes her a gift, and he can't find her to give the gift. Later on, it emerges that Tamar has become pregnant, and they come to ask Yehuda a shiloh, what shall we do? This is a young lady who is engaged, really, who's betrothed to the youngest son of Yehuda, because the Yibum has not yet taken place. She's also the daughter of the equivalent of a Kohen of Malki Tzedek, and she's pregnant, which would imply that she's had relations with a man. And what should be done? So he says the din is straightforward. She needs to be killed. Chazal go into why that is so. She amazingly does not betray him and is willing rather to be killed rather than to betray him and embarrass him. But she brings the things he gave her, the stick and the ring, the piece of clothing, and she sends it to him and she says, you should know that I'm pregnant to the man who owns these three things. Yehuda immediately realizes it's himself, and she's left him the option either to own up or to go ahead with the death sentence. It's up to him. And he says, Tzodko mimen, she's right, I was wrong. Now we have to have it in context, and when I learned this with the Chumashir a couple of years ago, I explained it in great detail. But what's important for us here is to know and understand that at that time, before the Torah was given, there was nothing wrong with what Yehuda did. Yehuda was not married, nor was Tamar. The fact that they were related, that she was a daughter-in-law of his, not only didn't that matter, but that was important because of the mitzvah of Yibum. There was in fact a desired relationship between the two of them, rather than that she should be sent out of the family. And that there wasn't an issue, there was nothing really wrong. And Chazal say part of what she explains to him when they do meet, is she informs him that she's unmarried, she informs him that she's been to the mikveh, that everything's kosher. And in those days, the halachas that applied before the Torah was given, there was nothing halachically wrong at all in what Yehuda did. Yehuda in fact sensed in her a woman of great modesty, a woman of exceeding specialness, and wanted to marry her. That was his intention. And afterwards she disappeared. Of course she disappeared. She just dressed up for the occasion. She was acting out as a kadesha. She was acting as a prostitute. Of course she wasn't really one. And she really wanted him to marry her. She didn't want it. He mistook her for a prostitute, so she played along with him. But according to many of the proportion, that was not her intention. Her intention was that when he spotted her and was attracted to her, she would start talking to him as she did, assuming that he would recognize her voice, and they would then engage in conversation, and they would establish a relationship, and they would get married. That was her intention. It didn't work out that way, but what did work out is that they had relations, and the predecessors of David HaMelech were born. And that is what the Medrash says while everything's going on. Yaakov is busy mourning. Just see the picture. What's happening at that very time? Yaakov is totally distraught. He's lost his son Yosef. Yosef is totally distraught. He's off to Egypt, never to see his family again. The brothers are all going out of their mind, especially Reuven. And Yehuda's busy sorting out his life. And this 22-year period during which everybody else was so distraught, Yehuda is busy laying the foundations of the household of the Mashiach, of the household of David HaMelech, of King David, and ultimately of the Mashiach himself. Even though there's no question that there was nothing halakhically wrong in what Yehuda did, there's something odd about the household of Mashiach. There's something odd about the household of David HaMelech. There are three cases where women manipulated men, three cases in the Tanakh, where women manipulated men into a marriage or into a relationship which halachically they ought not to have had to manipulate them into. They should just have been able to discuss it halachically. The first was Lot and his daughters. After the destruction of Sodom, the daughters thought that there was nothing left in the world. They thought the whole world had been wiped out. One can't blame them. And they realized that they were the only family that was saved. Lot and his two daughters were the only three people left. So they asked themselves, when before has there been a case like this where there's only been one family in the world? They said, Adam Arishon. Adam had children. Adam and Chava had children. Who did those children marry? They had to marry brothers and sisters. So surely the law is that we go back to that status, as it was in the case of Adam Arishon, and we have to marry within ourselves. Who have we got? We haven't got any brothers. So the only possibility of continuing the human race is to have relations with our father. So just as incest was allowed in the case of Odom, it must be allowed in their case too. Otherwise, how would the human race continue? That's a very logical argument. So what should they have done? They should have sat down with their father Lot, and they should have said, Reb Lot, we have a Shiloh. There's nobody left in the world. How are we going to keep the human race going? and Lot would have reasoned it out, and they would have discussed it, and surely Lot would have come to the same conclusion. But they didn't do that. They made their father drunk, and in his drunkenness they had relationships. They seduced him in his drunkenness. That's how they did it. From that relationship came Moab, and from Moab came Ruth, and from Ruth came David HaMelech. That was the beginning of one of the legs on which the household of David stood. The second case was our case. Tamar knows with Nevuah that she's got to marry into Yehuda's household. She knows that Yehuda's not going to let her marry the son. So she goes through this whole thing, dresses up as a prostitute on the street. Yehuda falls for her, and whether it's right or whether it's wrong, of course Yehuda did nothing halachically wrong, but it's still strange, it's still odd that the man's going out for a walk in the evening and he finds an attractive lady and establishes a relationship with her. Yehuda, the great Yehuda, still odd. If Tamar was so sure, why didn't she go to Yehuda and say to Rabbi Yehuda, I have a shaila. This is what I know with Nevuah. There's a law of Yibum. We've been through the first son, the second son. Surely now either the third son you've got to give me as a husband, or I should marry you. What's the halacha? Surely she could have discussed it with Yehuda halachically. And out of this relationship comes David HaMelech. And the third case was Rus and Boaz. But Naomi knows that out of Ruth is going to come the Melech HaMashiach, and out of the relationship with Boaz. So she goes through a whole thing as well, if you remember. She dresses in her best clothes, and she puts on her perfumes, and she goes in the middle of the night, and she creeps into Boaz's bedroom. Yeah, nothing happens that evening, everything's absolutely kosher and nice and beautiful. It's an odd way to do things. Why doesn't she go? Why doesn't Naomi go to Boaz and say to Boaz, we have a Shaila here, this is Ruth. This is what I know b'nevuah. There's also a question of Yibum. You're the closest relative. Surely the right thing is for you to marry her. Why don't they ask a shaila? Three cases that where the women knew the halacha and acted in accordance with the halacha, but they didn't go the halachic route. They went a very ordinary, sort of a human, almost a sexual route to create a shidduch with somebody that they knew had to exist, had to be. And out of these three relationships comes the household of David. The following is a piece of Medrash Tanchuma. On the Yosef Hurad Mitzrayim, Yosef was taken down to Mitzrayim. The Medrash starts off quoting a pasuk from Tehilim. Chazum if ha'leis alikim, meiro alilo al b'nei Odom. See the wonders of Hashem, the awe of the pretexts he brings on people. Omer Rabbi Yeshua ben Kocho, af ha'meiroi sha'ato meivi olim. Even when you cause terrible things to happen to us, Hashem, Ba'alilo at mevi'an, you bring us with false pretexts. You trick us into it. Borei, come on, I'll give you an example. Kesheboro HaKadosh Baruch Hu Esayulom Miyoy Marishun Boro Malach HaMovis. When Hashem created the world, He created the angel of death on the first day. Minayinom Rabbi Bechir Mishum Shinema V'choshech Al Pnei Tohim Zeh Malach HaMovis HaMachashich Pnei Mishol Briyas. It says right in the beginning, there was darkness on the face of the deep. Says the Chazal, that was the Malach HaMovis. The death was created at that point. Darkness and death was created right at the very beginning. The Adam Nivra B'Shishi. Adam was created 6 days later, or according to Dr. Schroeder, millions of years later. Va'alila Nitloboy, Shuvaviya Samiso Loilo. And who's blamed for bringing death into the world? God or Avro or Adam? We all blame Adam for it. Adam did it. But he was created 6 days after death. How can we say Adam brought death into the world? What can this be compared to? Man who decided he wants to get rid of his wife. It's not always so easy. So what did he do? Because of get. Before he came home from work one day, he stopped off at the Beis Din and he said, do me a favor, just write out a get. This is my wife's name, and this is the details. Write out the get. Nichnat lebeite v'aget biyode. He comes home, and under his arm is the get. Mevakish alila litna lo, but you can't just give a get for no reason. You've got to have a reason. Omalam mazguli es hakoshe eshte. Please bring me a nice cup of tea, he says to his wife. Mazgulu, she pours a cup of tea. Kivan shenotel hakos miyode omalah, he takes the cup of tea and he says, here's your get, you're divorced. I'm going to lose my pishy. She says, what did I do? What a shock this is. What's happened? I'm going to lose Imi Basie. Out of here. Out. Shemazati loy post poshu. Taste this tea. It's lukewarm. Is that how you make a cup of tea? Out you go. Amrullah, she says, in Farah Yusa Yodah Ashani Yasid Alimzullah Kos Poshu. You must have known I was going to make you a lukewarm cup of tea. Shukasanta get maybe yes or beyond. So you had to get under your arm before I even made the tea. You knew I was going to do it. What kind of a business is this? Afkach Omar Odom with Nakadish Boruch. So Odom said the same to Hashem, Ribbono Shelem. Actually, but also Elam Chakudim Shleyalofim Shono. This is a Torah, it's Lachoim. 2,000 years before you created the world, you created the Torah. Uchsivmon, what does it say in that Torah which you created 2,000 years ago? Zoyis satira odom kiyomus v'oil. All the laws of tumah are there. What happens if a person dies, and if a kohen is in the room when a person dies? All the laws of the tumah of death are in that Torah that you created 2,000 years ago. Ilulei shis kanto mavis labrius ayisa kosev v'okach. Would you have written all that parasha in the Torah if you hadn't created death for human beings? And you're blaming me for it. That's what David HaMelech means in the Pasuk, that the Ribbono Shel Olam brings horrible things into the world and blames us for it. And then the Medrash goes on to say the same happens with Moshe. The Medrash says that when Hashem says to Moshe, Ato tire asher ese leparo. Now watch, he says to Moshe, what I'm going to do to Paro. Say, Chazal b'milchemes Paro atarei v'ein atarei b'milchemes shloche v'echod malochim. Watch well what I'm going to do to Paro, because this is your last chance. You can watch what I'm going to do to Paro, but you won't see what I'm going to do to the 31 kings of Israel, of Canaan, because you'll be dead before then. Akivan shomalev shimun ha'amorim, and when Moshe got angry and said, listen, you rebellious ones at the rock, Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, lachein lo tavi'u zakar ha'zoh, oh, now you won't come into Eretz Yisrael. The Medrash God knew he wasn't going to come into Eretz Yisrael. He told him that already. It was decreed that he wasn't going to come into Eretz Yisrael. Why blame it on the rock? And the same principle we see with Yosef. The whole story of the father loved Yosef and made him the coat of colors, and the children hated Yosef, and the whole big story. What was it all for? It was to get Yaakov down to Mitzrayim. What could this be compared to? There's a cow that they want to put a yoke onto the cow and to plow with it, and she doesn't want it. What did they do? They took the calf from the mother and they took the calf to the field that they wanted to plow. And the calf started making a noise. The cow heard the calf making the noise. The cow ran to the field against its will. Bishvil beno, for its child. Hashem wants to fulfill the promise to Avram of your children will certainly, you will certainly know, because your children will go to Mitzrayim. And he created all this whole sequence of events so that they would go down to Egypt. So we have several cases where Hashem knows what he wants. There's a whole unfolding of historic events which is taking place, and he makes it seem as if we're doing it. An amazing dichotomy, but the Medrash doesn't resolve it. The Medrash just comments about it. What is the truth? It's like the age-old question. Is there predetermination? Does God know what we're going to do? Or isn't there? Is there free will? Same kind of issue in a way. Here we see it as if God counters on us for decisions we make, but retrospectively we realize that this was inevitable, it had to happen. So what's he blaming us for? As Odom says to him, why are you blaming me for death when you created death 2,000 years? You wrote death into the Torah 2,000 years before I was created. What do we see here? A very interesting dichotomy of life. And that is, yes, the Ribbono Shel Olam has a plan, and that plan unfolds through history. And who unfolds the plan? We do. Hashem uses us to play out history. The question now is, what role are we going to play in playing out history? Are we actors following a script? or are we free to make choices? And here's the dichotomy of life, and it requires an enormous sense of maturity to be able to understand that it is a dichotomy, that both are true. And the example that the Medrash Tanchuma gives of the lady with the cup of tea is the best example, and it's a very deep example. He stops off at the Beis Din on the way home and writes a get. He knows she's got to do something wrong. He can't just give her a get for nothing. So he asks her for a cup of tea. She brings a lukewarm cup of tea. She says, "You knew I was going to make a lukewarm cup of tea. That's why you came with a get underneath your hand." Who's right? They're both right. Yes, he did know she would make a lukewarm cup of tea. But she still had the freedom to make a hot cup of tea. She could have done whatever she wanted. He knew what she would do. But she still had freedom. It isn't necessary to consider there to be a contradiction between predictability and certainty. Or between predictability and certainty on the one hand, and free choice on the other. It's possible for a person to have to take responsibility for something inevitable as well. That's the maturity of the Torah that one has to understand. If we're going to say Hashem knows it's all predetermined, and therefore we have no free will, there is no responsibility. If we're going to say there's free will and Hashem has no plan, then there's no Ribono Shel Olam, then there's no, the whole concept of God's vision of the world doesn't exist. The truth is that both exist parallelly. Hashem says, "I want you to play out my plan, but to play it out not just by acting, but to play it out by making choices. And you're free to make those choices." Yes, I'm creating a circumstance which is going to guide those choices, but what's important about those choices is it puts responsibility on us. At the end of the day, she chose how to make the cup of tea. Nobody forced her to make a lukewarm cup of tea. Nobody forced her. The fact that it was predictable didn't deny her the opportunity to make the tea whatever way she wanted. And that enables her to take responsibility. It's so disturbing to hear how often people comment, if you just listen to people's language, how their talk is one of removal of responsibility. Things happened because. Something was because. Circumstance, situation, pressure, there are all sorts of things because. There's no because. At the end of the day, everything we do, we choose to do. And we have to take responsibility for that choice. The fact that our choice lands up playing a part in a master plan, that's a different dimension, and we have to be able to look at both dimensions. But the fact that we're playing a part in the master plan doesn't remove the responsibility of the choice from us. So at the point of making the choice, there's a difference between the present and the past. When we're in the present, we've got to understand that the responsibility for the choice is ours. When we've made that choice and taken full responsibility for it, we need to realize that that choice is molding history. That choice is playing a part in God's ultimate vision of the world. And yes, that creates an enormous responsibility on us, that places an enormous responsibility on us, but it gives us the sense of power of understanding the enormity of the contribution that we are making towards God's plan, that we're partners in it. What kind of partners would we be if we don't have the choice? What kind of partners would we do if all we are pawns in the process? If all we are machines acting out something pre-programmed, merely acting out a program that's been instilled into us, what kind of contribution would we be making to the world? We're making a contribution to the world by the choices we make. And really in this you've got the art of the distinction between what they refer to nowadays as the difference between management and leadership. A manager makes decisions for people. A leader leads people to make decisions for themselves. Yes, he leads them. Yes, he puts them into circumstances where they've got the tools to make the right decision. Yes, he hopes they'll make the kind of decision he wants them to make, to lead the organization, if it's a business, or the family, if it's a family, or whatever unit of organization it is. If one's leading people to make choices, one's leading them to make choices that will lead the organization in the direction that the leader wants to go. But that doesn't mean that the individual doesn't have the choice to make whatever decision he wants, and to take responsibility for that decision, and to share in the rewards when it comes out right, because of the contribution he made. That's the art of leadership. To be able to leave the person free to make choices. To guide him along those choices, to provide a framework for those choices, but to leave him to make those choices so that he can get the full reward of those choices. And so the Ribono Shel Olam has clear a plan and a vision that he has for the future. Nevertheless, the Ribbono Shel Olam leaves us to make the choices, and we have to take complete responsibility for those choices. So if we look in the story of Yehuda, we look at the story of any of the three examples I gave you of the development of the house of David, yeah, sure, it could all have done, be done very mechanically. Tamar could have had a talk with Yehuda, the daughters of Lot could have had a talk with Lot, Naomi and Ruth could have had a talk with Boaz, but that's not how Hashem wanted the house of David to be formulated. He wanted human involvement in the process. He wanted there to be a measure of humanity in the whole process of that choice. But it's not merely a thing done by some pre-programming halachic system that those choices are making. That there's a feeling of, I had to do it, what can I do? Lot would have come along and said, I had to do it. Why did I have to do it? My daughters came to me and said there was nobody left in the world. What choice does that leave me? Doesn't leave me any kind of choice at all. Mr. Shaw spoke this morning in shul about the difference of the love that a parent shows a child and the love that a husband and wife show each other. And he said the difference is not in the magnitude of the love. The love of a parent for his child is greater than the love of a spouse for the other spouse. The difference is that the reason that the love of a parent is so, of a spouse is so valuable to a person is because that's a love of choice, not a love of duty. A parent doesn't choose to love his children. It's instinctive. He might choose to have his children, but once he's had his children, he loves them. He has no choice in the matter. Whereas marriage is a choice that the couple make, and they don't only make it at the initial stages. They make it every day. They're free to love one another. They're not forced to love one another. The same thing it was with the creation of the household of David. Hashem didn't want a situation where Lot comes along and says, I had to have a relationship with my children. And Yehuda comes along and says, I had to have a relationship with Tamar because she was the Yevoma. What could I do? Halachically, I had no choice. And Boaz comes along and says, I had to do it. He wanted there to be free will. He wanted there to be a choice, a human choice, of Lot, even in his state of semi-drunkenness, making a choice. All the drunkenness did, it removed his inhibitions. In removing the inhibitions, he made a choice. Yehuda makes a choice. He sees this woman and he makes a choice not based on a halachic decision. I'm taking Tamar because I know with prophecy that out of this relationship, I'm taking Tamar because she's a beautiful, wonderful woman. She has tzniyus, she has beauty, she has character. That's why I'm taking her. I'm choosing to take this woman. And so she dresses herself up in such a way that all the other inhibitors aren't there, and Yehuda can make a free choice. Out of that free choice comes a David HaMelech. And likewise with Boaz. He sees Ruth there, and he sees what kind of a girl she is, and her amazing midos, and her tzniyus, and her beauty, and he says, I'm willing to do this not because I have to. I'm willing to do this because I want to do that. And that those three relationships are relationships created out of the choice, not out of the imposition. The fact that Hashem knew it would happen, the fact that Hashem set it all up, sure. But there was choice nevertheless. And therefore there's responsibility, and therefore there's reward. What's interesting to understand is that the opposite has to be true as well. We have to leave Hashem also a chance to make some decisions. It's not just Hashem leaves us the chance to make decisions, He doesn't impose on us. And He gives us the sense of responsibility of our own decisions, but we have to do the same. Rabbi Isaac Shur asks the following question. Further on in Parshas Vayechi, when Yaakov gives Yehuda a blessing, he says, Miteref b'ni oliso. From the destruction of my son, you have elevated yourself, you've emerged, says Rashi. You have emerged victorious from my suspicion that you were involved in the plot to kill Yosef. You removed yourself from that. You persuaded them that there's no gain in killing him, and that you therefore and you're responsible for saving him. Ask Rabbi Zichur, why is Yehuda praised for saving Yosef? What kind of salvation? Where did he save him from? Did he save him and take him back to his father? Did he save him and send him to Yeshiva? He saved him and sold him down as a slave to Egypt. Chazal tell us that when the brothers came down to Egypt to look for Yosef, when they came down for the famine, one of the things they were going to do was to look for Yosef. And where did they go looking? They went looking in the red light districts of Mitzrayim. They assumed that's where they would find him. What chance would a young man have being sold at the age of 17 down to Egypt, where there wasn't the chance of him linking into anything moral, never mind to anything Jewish? The most immoral and corrupt society that there was, a young boy of 17. What could have happened to him? As a slave he's sent down. Where would they find him? That's the only places they thought they would find him. So that must be the normal intention, the normal prediction of where such a young man would land up. So when Yehuda says, let's sell him as a slave to Mitzrayim, what could Yehuda have thought would become of him? Is that called saving him? Selling him as a slave to Mitzrayim, is that called saving? And the father congratulates him and says, Yishukach, you did wonderfully, you saved Yosef. It was a miracle that Yosef was saved. It wasn't Yehuda's doing. And in fact, Chazal say that in our parasha where it says, Vayered Yehuda, Yehuda went down, Chazal say because the brothers demoted him. He used to be their king. And the brothers came to him afterwards and said, Yehuda, we listened to you when you said, why should we kill him? We listened to you when you said, let's sell him to the Ishmaelim, let's sell him down to Egypt. And we would have listened had you said, let's return him to our father. Why didn't you tell us? Why didn't you insist? You had the power of personality, you had the forcefulness and the charisma, you had our confidence. Why didn't you force us to take him back to his father? Why did you let us do what we did? Father congratulates you. To understand that Rabbi Isaac Scher explains the Haftarah of Vayechi. We never have a chance to do Vayechi. It always falls in the holidays. So I don't mind just expanding into that for a few minutes to explain this concept. The Haftarah of Vayechi is from Melachim. But David HaMelech is about to die. And he calls his son Shlomo and he gives him some instructions. Among them is, V'hinei imcho Shimi ben Geiro ben Hayimini. You'll find among your royal household Shimi ben Gera. Behu kilalani klolonim retzes b'yom lechti machanoi. And when I was walking away, when I was running away, dejected as a refugee from the uprising of my own son Avshalom, Shimi ben Gera saw me in my state of dejection and cursed me too terribly. V'yashava loy ba'ashem le'moyer, and I swore to God saying, im amischo v'chorev, I will kill you. But he never did. David HaMelech never killed Shimi, which is already interesting. The din is that if one undermines the king, that's a capital offense. The king has to kill you. Now, David never killed Shimi. The Ator now tells his son, Al tenakehu, don't let him off. Ki ish chochom oto, because you're a wise man. The yodato es asher ta'aselo, and you'll find what to do. And you will bring his old age and blood down to the grave. In other words, you'll find a way to kill him. Why so difficult? Why so roundabout? Why not say, firstly, why didn't David kill him himself? And secondly, why instruct Shlomo to kill him? And why instruct him in such a funny way? He doesn't say kill him. He says, you're a wise man. You'll work out what to do already. You'll figure it out. And what does Shlomo do? After David dies, Shlomo puts Shimi under house arrest. He doesn't kill him. He says, Shimi, you don't put your foot out of Yerushalayim. And if you do put your foot out of Yerushalayim, you will be killed. So it's up to you. And then some slaves run away, and Shimi chases them to try and find them. He runs out of Yerushalayim. Shlomo arrests him and kills him. Who was Shimi ben Gera? Shimi ben Gera was Shlomo HaMelech's Rebbe. That's who Shimi ben Gera was. He was the biggest Talmid Chacham of the time, and he was the teacher of Shlomo HaMelech. He was as wise as Shlomo HaMelech. He was as much of a Talmid Chacham as Shlomo HaMelech. And he was the head of the Sanhedrin at that time. So we have to have Shimi ben Gera in proper perspective. Explains Rabbi Isaac Scher, there were two schools of thought. There was the school of Shaul, and in that school was Doeg HaEdomi, who was the head of Shaul's Sanhedrin, and Doeg also made David's life a misery. There was Doeg HaEdomi, a big great Talmid Chacham, and there was Shimi ben Gera, and Shaul were all part of the one school, and the other school was Shmuel and David. And the differentiation between these schools was a halachic dispute. And the halachic dispute started in the time of Ruth and Boaz. Because when Boaz wanted to marry Ruth, there was a shaila. What was the shaila? There's an issue. There's an issue that a Moabite is not allowed to come into the Jewish nation. can't marry a Moabite. And Ruth was a Moabite woman. So the question was, is that law that a Moabite can't marry into the Jewish people restricted to the men, or does it apply also to the women? Why can't a Moabite marry into the Jewish people? Because you remember when the Bnei Israel were going through the desert and they wanted to walk through Moab, Moab refused to give them entrance. And what should they have done, Chazal said? They should have come and brought them food and water. They were a nation, peace-loving nation. They weren't threatening anybody. On their way to Eretz Canaan, led by God, having just received the Torah, Moab are relations of them. Not only are Moab relations of them, but Moab owe their existence to them. Because their grandfather Avram saved Lot and his two daughters. So Moab owes them a debt of gratitude. And not only does Moab not fulfill that debt, not only does Moab not bring them food and water, but they refuse them entry into their land. The question is, who was responsible for that ingratitude? Was it the men only, or was it the women too? So Boaz called his Sanhedrin together and they discussed the matter. And they concluded, it wasn't the women's job to take food to the soldiers. That wouldn't be the right thing. That would be a lack of tzniut in any case. It would be immodest. It was the men. The men had to do it. So if the reason that a Moabite isn't allowed to marry into the Jewish people is because of the fact that they didn't take food and water, that's a claim against the men, not against the women. And therefore the women can marry into the Jewish nation. And therefore Boaz says, I can marry Ruth. The girl, the other man, the other closer relative who should have married Ruth, doesn't do so because he belonged to the school of thought that said, no, the law prohibiting a Moabite from marrying in applies to all Moabites, men and women. So already at the time of Boaz and Ruth, there were two views. One that saw the marriage of Boaz and Ruth as legitimate, and one who saw the marriage as illegitimate. Now, how interesting how in those days, people were willing to reach a conclusion, to reach a halakhic decision, and to live according to it, irrespective of what everybody else said. So Boaz marries Ruth, although there's a big school of thought that says he has no right to do so. It's against the halakha. And these two schools of thought persist all the way through till Shaul, all the way through till David. God tells Shmuel to go and anoint David. So Shmuel has a Beis Din, Shmuel has a school of thought too, and David is a descendant of Boaz and Ruth. Shaul and his school of thought, which includes Doeg HaEdomi, the Sanhedrin, Shimi ben Gera, all of this crowd, say David is illegitimate. There's no way he can be king. He comes from a marriage with a Moabite. And explains the Baizik Shur, Shmuel can't come along and say, yes, but God told me to do it. Because in halacha we don't use prophecy. Halacha has to be reasoned rationally. And prophecy plays no part at all. If I'm having a halachic discussion with a colleague, there are cases in the Gemara that are recorded like that. If I'm having a halachic discussion with a colleague, and I believe I'm right, and he believes he's right, but I can't disprove him. I can't prove him wrong. And eventually I say, but I had a prophecy. God appeared to me last night and he told me I'm right. It's irrelevant. And even if I say, God, tell him that it's true, he doesn't believe me. And if God comes in a bellowing voice and says, he's right, I did appear to him last night, and I'll say it again, he's right, you're wrong. It's irrelevant. It's totally irrelevant. Halacha has to be decided rationally and not by prophecy. So the fact that Shmuel had prophecy on his side, explains Rabbi Isaac Shur, makes no difference. There are still two schools of thought of equal stature. Shmuel and his Beis Din on the one hand, and Shaul and his Beis Din on the other hand. There were two Beis Dins. See, already in those days, two Beis Dins. And they're both of equal authority, both of great stature, arguing the question whether historically the marriage of Boaz to Ruth was legitimate or not. If it was legitimate, then David has a legitimate claim to the crown. If it wasn't legitimate, David has no claim to the crown. And so Shaul and Doeg and Shimi, who make David's life a misery, all believe that David is a pretender, that David has no right whatever to the crown, and that he's illegitimately making Shaul's life a misery. And that's why they persist. Explains Rabbi Isaac Shur, even when David is about to die, he's not 100% sure who's right. Amazing thing. I'm sure that I've got to conduct my life according to my school of thought. My great-great-grandfather Boaz believed it was right. That's good enough for me. Shmuel Hanavi, who anointed me, believed it was right. That's good enough for me. But there is a school of thought that says it was wrong. And I have to respect that that's a possibility, and maybe that school of thought will one day become the predominant one. In which case, Shimi will turn out to have been right. How can I put a man to death when I'm not sure that he's really a Mered B'Malchus? There's a shadow of doubt. Look at the degree of respect that David HaMelech had for the other view. Yes, I've got to conduct my life according to my view, but I've got to respect that there's another view which might one day become the predominant one. What a limud that is, how much that teaches us. How while we've got to be firm of going our own way, going according to the way we've been taught, we've got to recognize that there are other ways too. And therefore he says to Shlomo, use your wisdom. On the one hand, Rabbi Isaac Shur explains the Ramban Paskins, a Moired B'Malchus, if one undermines the king, Ein lo chelek lo'olam habo v'chayav miso. He has no part in the world to come, and is it's a capital offense. He's guilty of a death sentence. David is worried. If I put Shimi to death, maybe it's not right, and maybe I'm putting him to death for no reason. Maybe his school of thought is the predominant one. If I don't put Shimi to death, maybe he won't have olam habo, because by not giving him the death sentence, I'm ensuring that he won't go to olam habo. I'm depriving him of eternity. So what's the right thing to do? Because by giving him the death sentence, I'm saying he's doing tshuva, that's his atonement, and he comes to Olam Habo. So David finds himself in an incredible predicament, and it's Shlomo's Rebbe. This is the man who taught Shlomo Torah. And Shlomo now has to take the decision what to do with this man. If I kill him and I'm wrong, I'm guilty of murder. If I don't kill him, I'm causing my Rebbe not to have an Olam Habo. What do I do? It says Shlomo HaMelech, I'll put him under house arrest. That's it. If he walks out of that, that's his decision. Then I'll put him to death. I'll put him to death for undermining the house arrest. Explains Rabbi Isaac Shur, that's what Yehuda did. All that Yehuda did was he removed the finality of death from the sentence on Yosef. He left God to do something too. Yes, sending him to Egypt was a difficult thing. But all he did was he said, to leave this young man in the pit, we're ensuring his death, we're not leaving God and out. We've got to let God do something here too. Let's sell him to Egypt, and if he's a tzaddik, because we're not 100% sure we're right. Halachically, we've got to act according to our decision. But to say that we're 100% sure that there couldn't be another view, we're not. Let's therefore leave God and out. Let's leave something for the Ribbono Shel Olam to do as well. And that's the counterpart of the first part of the shir this evening. The first part of the shir is God leaves us to make decisions and to make choices. The second part is we must leave God to make some decisions as well. We don't have to do everything ourselves. We don't have to plan down to the last detail so that there's nothing left for God to interfere with, because God doesn't interfere that easily. If we take every last decision ourselves, the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't interfere that easily. So many people tell me in business, and my own experience is the same, that very often one sets off on a strategy. To do something, you know exactly what you want to achieve, you know exactly why you want to achieve it, and you know exactly how you're going to achieve it. And you set off to do it. And you land up not succeeding. You land up doing something better. That you didn't plan. But had you not set off on the first journey, you wouldn't have done the second one either. There was once a Rav who came out to South Africa, I think, to raise some money, and he gave a talk in the Beis HaMedrash many years ago, and I'll never forget it. And he told the following story. He said, when you catch a big fish and you open it up, you sometimes find a little fish inside, a little fish that the big fish swallows. And I've checked up with fishermen, this is true apparently. He said, but you would imagine when you open up the big fish that you'll find the fish tail in first, because the big fish chases the little fish and catches them from behind. So you would imagine that you would find the tail in first in the big fish. So if you find the little fish in the throat of the big fish, you would imagine the little fish's face to be facing outwards, out of the big fish. He says, but that isn't so. It's the other way around. You find the fish have come into the big fish head first. How's that possible? The big fish goes chasing after the little fish, they run away. How do they get into his mouth head first? He says, because the big fish go chasing after the little fish. That's true, but they never catch the little fish. they catch other fish swimming in the opposite direction. And apparently that's true. So if the big fish didn't chase the little fish, they would never catch anything. You've got to chase after the little fish, but you need to know what you're chasing after you don't get. But if you're chasing correctly, you get a whole lot of other things that you didn't even think of. If you leave something open to Hashem as well. If you try and plan it in such a way that you leave yourself no option but to catch the little fish, the ones you're chasing after, and you make it impossible to catch anything else, you'll catch nothing. And you'll starve. Because the Rebbeinu Shlom has no option. You've left him no option. One has to leave oneself the option. Yes, this is where I'm going. This is what I'm trying to do. But leave something to Hashem as well. Shlomo HaMelech put Shimi in house under house arrest. Leave something to God. God can decide whether he's going to walk out of there or not. Shimi can decide whether he's going to walk. I don't have to decide everything myself. I don't have to take everything on myself. Yehuda comes along and says, why kill the boy? Why put him in the pit? Let God take some decisions too. Let's get rid of him. I agree we want to get rid of him. Let's send him down to Mitzrayim. Let Hashem decide whether he should die or not. Why should we make that decision? And so we see that there's a reciprocal arrangement between ourselves and Hashem. And that's a true partnership. A partnership is not when we make other people do things for us. That's not a partnership. If we force Hashem to do things for us, that's not a partnership. If Hashem forces us to do things for him, that's not a partnership. What Hashem does is he puts us into situations and leads us along a way where we can make choices for which we can take responsibility. And those choices help Hashem act his scheme out. Not our actions help him do it, our choices help him do it. And we make those choices which are the building bricks of history. In the same way, we have to leave Hashem the opportunity, not just use Hashem to fulfill our plans. Our plans have to leave a place for Hashem, that Hashem can make some decisions for us as well. It's not only for us to make the decisions and leave God to implement it. We have to make decisions and we have to plan the implementation of our decisions, but we have to leave a little bit of flexibility. Because sometimes we think we know what we're doing, sometimes we think we know where we're going, and Hashem has different plans altogether. If we leave the opening, Hashem will lead us there. If we don't, He won't. If we leave the opening, Hashem will make decisions for us that are far superior to any decision we could make. If we leave the opening, Hashem will lead us in ways which are far more beautiful and far more important than any ways we could have planned for ourselves. We have to chase after the little fish, but we need to know that those aren't the fish we catch. It's the fish that are swimming in different directions which we didn't even know about, that Hashem brings right into our mouth when we're not even looking for them. That's the way life is. And that's that reciprocal relationship of a partnership between the Ribbono Shel Olam and Am Yisrael.